Let's take our Bibles and turn to Numbers chapter 20. Numbers chapter 20. We'll be ending up in chapter 21. We're going to look this morning at chapter 20 to help set the stage. And, you know, as we look to the book of Numbers, it's a part of Israel's history, and we see their journey from the bondage in Egypt to the promised land. And, oh, the episodes that you see in their history. And there are so many lessons that we can look back and see that they were learning the hard way, and we get the advantage of being able to sit down and read our Bibles and see the struggles that they faced. And one of the challenges that Israel had continually, time after time after time, as we're going to look this morning, is the tendency to complain, not seeing what everyone else sees. Whenever you and I look at Numbers 20 and 21 this morning, we're going to see their complaining, their endless complaining, and how much God had provided for them, and yet they could not see all of His goodness towards them. They could only see the loss. They could only see the difficulty, the discomfort. And I think that the amazing part of complaining is that we think that no one else sees what only we can see. As I was grabbing my suit out of the closet this morning and putting it on, I thought, well, I'll wear that one. And I remember the story behind this particular suit that was given to me. It was Miss Jean Berry gave this to me many, many years ago. As I put it on this morning, I thought, it doesn't fit like it fit many, many years ago. But as I put it on, I remembered the reason why she gave it to me. She's told me that she wanted to get me a suit that fit me. She was a seamstress. She could tell just by looking at me how it was supposed to fit. And when she told me what size I was, I argued with her. And I said, oh, Miss Jean, that's not my size. She says, I know you think it's not your size, but take this suit and try it on, and I think you'll find that it fits you much better. I said, but you've never even measured me. She says, I don't need to measure you to get you in a suit that fits you. I'm good at what I do. Just trust me. I put it on, and I'm still wearing it today, albeit a little bit more snug this morning. So as we learn about complaining, as we look about complaining, I want to keep the focus this year in the series on the Lord, the year of the Lord, and lifting Him up this morning is the title, Lift Him Up. We're going to look at Numbers chapter 20. We're going to see some Israel's history, the blessings and defeats that Israel finds. And that seems to be the pattern. There's a blessing, there's a defeat. I think there's a lot of correlation to what happens in our life, that not every day is a victory. Have you found that? Not every day is the greatest day of your life. Some days are days that you just wish that you could have them just stricken from the calendar, taken from your memory because of the amount of problems that you had to deal with. And you think every day that the problems that you're going through are as big as it's ever going to get, and then it just seems to be that the next day you learn there's probably bigger problems out there. Am I right about that? I no longer say this was the worst day of my life as far as problems are concerned. I just keep my mouth quiet because I know God will teach me a lesson otherwise. We look this morning, though, at Numbers chapter 20, and we're going to see where Israel finds himself in a place with no water. In Numbers chapter 20, verse 1, we find that then came the children of Israel, even the whole congregation, in the desert of Zin in the first month. And the people abode in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. We find a little bit about the place that they're at. They've stopped at an oasis. They are going to be able to park here and to replenish and restock and get some water here at the oasis of Kadesh. And Miriam, Moses' sister, passes away here. So we come into verse 2, and there was no water for the congregation, which is strange for there not to be any water in an oasis because, I mean, that's what it does. Remember, we're talking about desert living, and water is hard to come by. There wasn't enough water to go around for everyone. There was no water for the congregation, it tells us in verse 2. And they gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron. And the people chode with Moses and spake, saying, would God that we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. And why have you brought up the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our cattle should die there? And wherefore have you made us to come up out of Egypt and to bring us into this evil place? It is no place of seed or of figs or of vines or of pomegranates. Neither is there any water to drink. But God's going to provide for Israel. Look at verse 6. And Moses and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation, and they fell on their faces. Remember their hearts as they go to the Lord's presence to find some relief. Moses and Aaron have a grumbling group. The entire camp is on edge and is complaining and has made some really serious accusations about Moses' leadership and God's provisions. Moses and Aaron go before the Lord, and they fall on their faces, and the glory of the Lord appeared unto them. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Take the rod, and gather thou the assembly together, thou and Aaron thy brother, and speak ye unto the rock before their eyes, and it shall give forth his water, and thou shalt bring forth to them water out of the rock. So shalt thou give the congregation and their beasts drink. And Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he had commanded him. But we know in this story that this is a pivotal moment for Moses in the journey towards the promised land, because this is going to be an opportunity for Moses to stumble and fail. And it's going to have consequences for him and his leadership, and where he is not going to be allowed to take the people. Look at Moses' failure. I mean, it seems to be that he's in a desert with no water, and God's provided him with the solution. Go and speak to a rock. Moses takes the rod, and we find out in verse 10 what he does. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said unto them, Moses being a preacher. That's what Aaron's job was, right? But Moses is going to, he's had enough. He's had it up to his eyeballs with the people. You can hear it in his voice. And I'm going to encourage you to read it with the sound of that you would hear as you're taking a road trip with your children. You know, that the complaining, the murmuring in the backseat, the, Mom, he's looking at me, or the, Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Moses is going to respond in a serious and severe way. He says, Hear now, ye rebels, must we fetch you water out of the rock? And Moses lifted up his hand, and with his rod, he smote the rock twice. And the water came out abundantly, and the congregation drank, and their beasts also. And the Lord spake unto Moses and to Aaron, Because ye believe me not to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel, therefore ye shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them. This is the water of Meribah, because the children of the Lord strove with the Lord, and he was sanctified in them. I want to point out, it was Moses who's standing before the people and has an opportunity to be a leader, to set the proper example for the complaining people. And what does he do? He and his, well, in his sped upness, he says, Must we fetch water out of this rock? And I know a lot of times we emphasize the striking of the stick as the object. But I think Moses' problem is even before he sticks and strikes the rock. It is him questioning what God has told him to do. It is him thinking that he is part of the solution, and he is, because God told him to do so, but he is complaining and grumbling here just like the people. You can hear it in the statement as he calls out the people for their rebellious hearts. And you say, wait a minute, how in the world, wouldn't this be a great teaching moment for Moses to stand up there and tell the people, call them out? Yeah, but he does something extra in his rage. He does strike the rock twice. Water comes out like the Lord had told him it would. But we find here in this moment that it's accounted not just to Moses, but also to Aaron also is being complicit in part of the stumbling. You've got a problem in Israel of people taking the wrong side. You've got on the one side, you've got all of the children of Israel mumbling, grumbling, and complaining, quarreling over what the Lord has provided. That he hadn't given enough, that it wasn't good enough, it wasn't acceptable. It would have been better for them to be dead than to go through the present struggles that they're going through. As a matter of fact, the word that we saw there, Meribah, where the waters were named, that word Meribah means quarreling or striving. And we find that it is one side quarreling over what is given. And there's two sides to this position or to the moment. There is the one side that's upset with what God has given, and then there is the God who provides. And Moses and Aaron move away from the God-provided side and come over to Israel's complaining side. And I can see that because of the judgment that he gets, that he's not going to be able to take the children of Israel into the promised land, and that Aaron is also not going to be able to see the promised land. You say, wait a minute, they're the third party there. They're the ones who are wanting to do the right thing. They're the ones who are wanting to be on God's side, and the children of Israel are the ones who are complaining. But yet you find Moses in his actions, in his adding to what God had told him to do. It was severe enough that God was not going to allow him to see the promised land or be the one who leads the children of Israel into the promised land. And I'm going to pause right here because I want to ask you a question. Because you and I are made up a lot like Moses. We may not have the same responsibilities. We may not be leading a group of people across the desert towards the promised land. But you and I encounter problems every day. And I want to ask you, how many problems do you think it would take before you would stumble? How many problems do you have loaded on you before you say, enough, I can't take any more. Lord, you put too much on me. Have you ever found yourself at that place? I think many times in our lives, we struggle with this reality. That I can handle one or two problems. I can't handle four, five, or six. I don't need another problem to deal with. And we think about our problems in terms of what we're capable of handling. And yet, what if God is bringing us to a place for us to see that, yes, we are inadequate, but he is so much greater. So the next time that you're overloaded with problems, before you grumble, before you complain, pause and say, Lord, are you teaching me something about you? Help me get that lesson before I complain, because I don't like where learning the lesson the hard way takes me. We find now that Aaron is going to pass as part of the story in Numbers chapter 20. We're going to skip down to verse 23. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in Mount Hor by the coast of the land of Edom, saying, Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, for he shall not enter into the land which I have given unto the children of Israel, because ye rebelled against my word at the water of Meribah. Aaron was there, and he knew what Moses was supposed to do, and sides with his brother. Verse 25, take Aaron and Eleazar his son, and bring them up into Mount Hor, and strip Aaron of his garments, and put them upon Eleazar his son, and Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, and he die there. And the Lord did as Moses commanded, and they went up into the Mount Hor in the sight of all the congregation. And Moses stripped Aaron of his garments and put them on Eleazar his son, and Aaron died there on top of the mount, and Moses and Eleazar came down from the mount. And when all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, they mourned for Aaron 30 days, even all the house of Israel. Numbers chapter 20, we find Moses losing his sister. He's going to lose his brother. He's going to lose entry into the promised land. He loses a lot in Numbers chapter 20. Moses at his age also, I think something that we didn't talk about, it's understood, Moses now is advanced in years. Miriam and Aaron were getting up there. It wasn't so much a surprise that Aaron passed or that Miriam passed, because sometimes we have that expectation. But Moses loses a lot in Numbers chapter 20, but he also gains a lot. We find Israel mourning the loss. And I want to talk to you about what he gains, and I want to talk to you about where Israel's at in Numbers chapter 21. But before we do that, I want to ask you this question: how much loss must I endure before I stop complaining? I want to answer why it is that we complain before we even get into the message this morning. Looking at Numbers chapter 20, the reasons that we see Israel complaining is that they feel like they're forsaken, thinking that I'm all alone. How easy is it us to get to that same place? I'm the only one. No one else knows what I'm going through. I'm forsaken. I don't have anybody to stand with me. I'm doing this all on my own. Israel also thinks that they are God forsaken, thinking that they have been neglected by God. When they question what Moses had led them, and of course Moses is leading them as God has instructed, and they look at the every little issue, and you say, wait a minute, they're not complaining about what God has done. They're just complaining, 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 because that's what they do. But yet, we find them murmuring and complaining in chapter 21. And you'll see what I mean in just a moment here. But we complain because we think that we're forsaken. We complain because we think that we are God forsaken, that even God has forgotten us. We find ourselves ungrateful for everything that he has provided. It was Philip Keller in his interesting little book, A Shepherd Looks at Psalm 23, who makes this statement: we are quick to forget our blessings and slow to forget our misfortunes. Isn't it the way it works? Now, the good times, the great blessings that God gives to us, sometimes overshadowed by all the problems that we experience in life. We complain because we think that God hasn't provided enough to make us comfortable. I think that's the modern problem that we live with, and I think that's the problem that Israel is struggling with too. God just hasn't done enough to make me comfortable. And all the while, as we will wrap up this morning, we will see God provides everything to make me whole. And we turn our complaining to gratitude when we begin with this big idea to see that God provides all I need to make me whole. Would you join me in prayer now as we ask the Lord to bless our time and his word? Lord, we come to you this morning. We lift up your name and we thank you so much. Lord, as we look to you this morning to see you in the book of Numbers, we know that Israel has been led by you as a pillar of fire by night and a cloud of smoke by day. Lord, you are there in every part of the story. You haven't forgotten your people. You haven't forsaken your people. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to resist the temptation to think that we are all forgotten and all alone, that no one else cares, because we know, Lord, that there is no one that cares like you. Oh, Lord, would we see you today? Would we see you in the blessings? Would we see you in the trials? Lord, we realize that life has a purpose. You're teaching us something about you, and you're teaching us something about ourselves. Help us to get this lesson straight, and spare us, Lord, the fiery serpents. We ask these things in your name. Amen. We come to Numbers chapter 21, right after all of the trouble in Numbers 20, and Israel is going to experience their first victory as a conquest of people. Now, I mean, you think about the victories that they have had. The Lord has taken them out of bondage, out of Egypt. He's led them across the dry ground of the Red Sea. But when I talk about the first victory, this is going to be the first time that they start to conquer the land, and they're going to start to conquer the Canaanites. We're going to find Israel versing Hormah in the great battle. As we look to Numbers chapter 21, verse 1. And when King Arad the Canaanite, which dwelt in the south, heard that Israel came by the way of the spies, then he fought against Israel and he took some of them prisoners. And Israel vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, if thou wilt indeed deliver this people into thy hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. And the Lord hearkened to the voice of Israel and delivered up the Canaanites, and they utterly destroyed them and their cities. And he called the name of the place, would you say with me, Hormah. We find here in these three verses, the circumstances begin to change. There's some of Israel are taken captive. Israel is rallied to fight, and the Lord provides the victory for Israel. We find in this moment a victory that is clearly a one-sided victory and a one-sided defeat. I had you say the word Hormah just a moment ago. It's because if the word Hormah literally means destruction. It was a defeat that was so clear to the Canaanites that the name of the place where they fell was called destruction. That's a pretty serious victory for one side, and a pretty serious and clear failure, defeat on the other side. And it's interesting to stop and make this commentary that you can see what happens when you stop complaining and you start fighting. But I want to caution you, because there's a word in there that's a problem. It's not the you stop complaining, because that's important for us as believers to learn to be content with where the Lord has us and the circumstances that we endure. It's the you fighting that gets me scared. So whenever I stop complaining, when I start fighting, I have to be careful that I don't fall into that temptation like Moses did. To think that I had to do it all on my own, into my own strength. Because that's me forsaking. That's me forsaking God, thinking that it all is up to me and it all relies upon me. And I'm not shirking our responsibility this morning. I'm just saying we need to learn that balance and learn that perspective. We need to learn to keep straight who it is that actually provided the victory. Because if Israel is to think about herself, who's now rallied and she's seen her first victory, and I tell you, I was on a little league baseball team that never, ever won. It's probably because I was on the baseball team. But as I think about that one time that I do remember winning, do you know how we won? The other team forfeited, didn't even come out. How about that, Michael Edmonds? Our victory was chalked up. I mean, it tasted so sweet to know that we had won that day. Thank the Lord for the chicken pox. But we need to keep straight who provides. And we need to remember what we can accomplish when we keep our focus and our priorities straight. We find for Israel victory, finally, at last, in Numbers 21. That is a long journey to get to that first victory. And then right after it, the fiery snakes. Look with me at verse 4. And they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to compass the land of Edom, and the soul of the people was much discouraged because of the way. And the people spake against God, against Moses, wherefore have you brought us out of Egypt? Actually, let's read it the way we probably would hear it. Remember the kids in the back seat? Wherefore you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no bread, neither is there any water, and our soul loatheth this light bread. Israel's got something to complain about. Here they find themselves forgotten again. They're ready to die in the wilderness, or they're expecting to die in the wilderness, because they have the lack of resources. There's not any water, there's not any bread, nothing to eat and nothing to drink. Okay, we are human and we have to have bread and water to drink. But as you read it, you see that it's not that they didn't have the provisions. They loathed the manna that God had provided for them. They wanted something different than what God had provided for them. And as we look at their statement, we realize that they are not forgotten, that they're not dead, that what they say is not true, but we do know that they are not grateful. And so the Lord, as he does graciously, sends relief. Look with me in verse 6. And the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, and much people of Israel died. Death by snake bite. I don't know how you read the scriptures or how you play it in your mind, but I just imagine that some of you are ready to swoon when you think about the thought of getting a snake bite, or at least seeing a snake. I don't think there's a one of us that could handle witnessing what Israel witnessed this morning with the fiery snakes that came upon them. And I know oftentimes we think about how the Lord uses animals in the Old Testament, about how the Lord sent birds to eat up those who complained against or spoke out against God's prophet, and there was a warning there. We look here at the fiery serpents that are sent. Their bites must be incredibly painful. Because I think that the fiery serpent is not that these snakes are on fire. Though maybe that's the way I envision it, that there are these little fire trails coming after people. These are snakes that I understand even to this day. There are snakes in the desert that the Bedouins, the nomads that travel across the desert, that they sometimes encounter. And whatever this critter is, whether it was something that was there and they just come out en masse to attack Israel, or if it was something that was created in this moment, one moment in time, which I think it was probably the snakes overran them, it's the death by snake bite that takes many of Israel, and many die because of it. But you could be optimistic here and say, okay, well, a lot of people have passed. There's more resources now for fewer mouths. So the Lord's provided because people have died and there's not as many people to eat the bread and drink the water that they had with them. And so they had their prayers answered, right? But that's not the lesson that they were supposed to learn. The lesson that they were going to learn is, what does it take to bring you back to God? What does it take to bring you back to seeing what God has provided for you and being grateful with what he's brought for you? Number 7, therefore the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned and we have spoken against the Lord and against thee. Pray unto the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. And Moses prayed for the people. There's a connection that we see here between judgment and contrition. That's the circumstances that bring us to our knees and the position of our heart that says, I have done wrong. I've had that remorse. It is acknowledging what I have done and who I have offended is what the word contrition means. It is my broken heart. Lord, against thee and thee alone have I sinned. It is me, Lord, that failed you. But I want you to know that taking that step of contrition, it doesn't provide the relief. It just comes, it's that difficult place of being brought to your knees. For all those times in your life when you might have been disciplined, when your mom and dad lean you over the bed, back in the day when it was still sanctioned by the Geneva Convention, where corporal punishment was allowed in homes, whenever you experienced a spanking, or whether you experienced the timeout, what was worse, standing there and taking the punishment, or the thought that you had hurt mom and dad? Hurting mom and dad never, ever entered into the equation until after mom and dad taught me the lesson by the seat of my pants, or put my nose in a corner. But I was in that generation that would have begged to have my nose put in a corner. Just don't bring out that leather strap. The admission part doesn't provide the relief. It starts to provide the lesson and the insights to where we need to go. The relief comes when the curse is reversed. So Israel is crying out for the Lord to deliver them. They come to Moses and they realize that they're sinning, they're grumbling, they're complaining. The lessons that they needed to learn, that this judgment that is upon them is because they have been terrible. They have been ungrateful, and the serpents are coming in and biting them, and many are dying. And to learn that lesson, we could end the story there and say, ah, the story's over. Israel learned their peace. But there's no relief for Israel until the serpents go away. Because really, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for that resolution. We're looking for that relief. And we need to have that curse, that judgment stop so we can get on to the good stuff. Well, look what the Lord does in verse 8. And the Lord said unto Moses, make me a fiery serpent and set it on a pole. And it shall come to pass that everyone that is bitten, when he looketh upon it, shall live. And Moses made a serpent of brass and put it upon a pole. And it came to pass that if a certain had bitten any man, when he beheld the serpent of brass, he lived. Here's the Lord's provision for relief. Look to that brass snake on the pole. Does that still work today? I have heard in the past there were people in the community that had the ability to speak fire out of you if you got burned or you got stung or something. They had a special gift that they could talk to you and talk it out of you. I haven't seen that in a while. Does that still work today? Does the looking at a snake on a stick help you today? And then I got to thinking, wait a minute. Every time I go to the doctor's office, I see this symbol. Have you seen this before? The serpent on a stick. And of course, the doctors charge us a rate that it's not brass. It's made out of gold, right? Have you ever seen this symbol and think that it makes a connection or there's a connection in Numbers chapter 21, the fiery serpent? If you do, then you are not right. Because it is not sourced in scriptures. It's sourced in Greek mythology. This is the staff of Asclepius. He was an individual, according to the mythology, that was fathered by the gods, who was trained in medicine. And one day he was tasked with trying to heal somebody. As he is there contemplating what it will take to save this person, a snake comes upon him. He takes his rod and he bashes the serpent's head in, and the serpent dies right there. And as he sits there and continues to ponder, another serpent comes up with an herb in his mouth and puts it in the other snake's mouth, and the snake comes back to life. And according to the mythology, he realizes this is the medicine that's needed to restore life to the person that he was trying to heal. The staff of Asclepius. Farthest thing in the world from Numbers 21, the fiery serpent on the stick. And I said that because I am so grateful that we live in a day with great medicine. I'm grateful, and I don't have the constitution to think about the way we applied medicine in the past. As you read back in history about what medicine thought was the secret and the solution to making sure somebody felt better by cutting a hole in your arm or in your head and letting blood run out to let the bad blood out, because that's what was making you sick. And I know that there's bad blood, but let me keep it in my body, else I will pass out when I see it. We have a tendency, though, to think that our doctors are the answer. And I say, trust your doctor. But I want to tell you where my experience here, what is shifting in medicine today. Something that I hadn't seen. I remember many years ago, I would ride down to the Chapel Hill Hospital with Pastor Willis, and he'd say, well, you know, back in the day, there was a place for the pastors to park right up front at the hospital. It's a clergy spot. He said, you're missing out on that this day. We have to park in the parking garage and walk all the way across because they took that space away. I was over at another hospital in Durham. One of the doctors came in and said, who are you? And I said, I'm the pastor. And he said, well, I need you to leave because your services aren't needed here. I remember there were times when the doctors would say, well, I'll step out and I'll let you finish, and then I'll come back in and we'll work. But I see this trend today that is a trend probably that's always was there. It's just so much more vocal nowadays. People don't need the Lord. People don't want the Lord, and we don't want people thinking that the Lord is the answer to our problems. No, I'm grateful for the medicine that he gives us today, and I know that the Lord has created the wisdom, and he's provided the blessings for us to live in a day with unparalleled medical technology. But I want to stop short of saying that we think that we're okay and we're impenetrable because medicine can take care of us, that I can be careless, that I can be reckless. You know, the doctors always tell you, and I don't like it. I get in the argument with my doctor when he tells me, you know, your blood's a little bit out of whack. You need to change your diet. And I'll look at him and I'll say, well, you're bigger than me. What kind of diet are you on? And he'll say, don't talk about me, but you need to exercise more. And I'll say, do you exercise? And he says, no, I'm a doctor. I'm busy. And I say, well, whenever we both start exercising together, that's when I'll start doing it. And we laugh. But you know the temptation, the hesitation that he's trying to tell me to do something that he's not willing to do. I'm only going to trust him so far. But it comes down to asking this question, whose life are our hands really in? Who's the one who knows what we have need of? Who's the one that provides? As we close, I want to look just before John 3:16. This is John chapter 3, verse 11. Verily, verily, I say unto thee, we speak that we do know and testify that we have seen, and ye receive not our witnesses. This is Jesus speaking. If I have told you earthly things and you believe not, how shall ye believe? And if I tell you of heavenly things, and no man hath ascended up to heaven, but he that came down from heaven, even the Son of Man which is in heaven. And as Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have eternal life. And there the words of Jesus connect with Numbers chapter 21. That the grace that the Lord provided for Israel in their day by having the snake on a stick was going to provide a temporary relief, to provide deliverance for those who had been bitten, to look at that staff, and they would be delivered from death. Israel would go on to keep that staff, and as we look in 1 Kings, we see that Israel goes crazy and starts to worship that staff and gets destroyed. But the temptation that we live in is to think that sometimes God provides solutions where he's not the solution. And that's not the way that he works. Remember a few moments ago I asked the question, how much loss must I endure before I stop complaining? We sang about it just a few moments ago. The songs that we pick are always deliberate and intentional. We sang that every joy or trial falleth from above. You know, the Lord brings things into our life to bring us to that place where we either see him clearly or we don't see him clearly. The goal is that we see him clearer, that we see him deeper and truer. But just like Israel, on the heels of the victory, starts complaining again, how much loss must I endure before I stop complaining? What does it take to bring you back to God? For Israel, coming off of that great victory and then the fiery serpents that come and bite, it's what it took for them in that moment. But I want to tell you that it is an incomplete and not the rest of the story. Because Jesus explains in John chapter 3, verse 14, what it was all about. It was about him being lifted up. And how much does it take for you to stop complaining? How much does it take to find that relief? It is Jesus lifted up that is the answer. And whose life and whose hands is my life really in? It is in the Savior that's lifted high. And the connection between the serpent on the stick, not saying that Jesus is likening himself to a stick. He's talking about the hope. The hope was for the people to direct their eyes to the Lord, where the Lord had told them to direct their eyes. And Jesus is telling those people who are listening to him in his day in John chapter 3, that the secret that him coming down as the Son of God was because he was going to be lifted up and he was going to go on the cross. And I know you think, well, we hear a lot about the death, the burial, and the resurrection of Jesus when we come to church. Seems to be what we always talk about, and we should never stop talking about it because it is the answer, and it is our identity in Christ because of what he has done on your behalf and on my behalf. It's what unites us together, his sacrifice for you and for me. And when you and I complain, and when you and I grumble, and when you and I stumble, stop and evaluate and say, was this because God wasn't God enough? Or is it because I'm trying to do it in my own strength? I'm trying to find a way to find the happiness and try to find the success or try to find the connection that doesn't include him, doesn't involve him. But for Israel's identity, for our identity and our place of worship, it always revolves wholly around him, the Savior, lifted high. The big idea that we had this morning is that God provides me all I need to make me whole. And sadly, we look to other places from time to time to try to find a way around what we know the answer to be. The one who stumbles is the one who rejects Jesus. John 3:16, which flows right after Jesus' statement about being lifted up, "For God so loved the world that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life." It's not the statement of the one who rejects, but the one who trusts. Because the one who values Jesus most is the one who lives. And it was a lesson that the children of Israel had to learn in the desert that day. And it took fiery snakes to bring them to that place. So they come back to God and say, "We've sinned." And God sends the relief. And here's how we keep ourselves from grumbling and complaining and getting to that place. We worship every day. We worship regardless of the circumstances. "Lord, there's just too much for me to deal with today. Can't take anything else, so I'll put this off to tomorrow. We'll wait for a reset." But when we're at our weakest is when he is at his greatest. And the potential for us to see through our inadequacies, his superiorities. Don't miss out on the value of the trial that you might find yourself in. Let it bring you back to that place of worship. May this be our prayer. "Lord, spare me of snakes that teach me of my weakness and of your greatness."